Okay, and we're back talking with Dr. John DeSalvo about his truly magnificent new book published by Barnes & Noble called Decoding the Pyramids. And it's available at Barnes & Noble online and, of course, in the stores. On the Father's Day table, I am told, there are so many mysteries about the Great Pyramids. The Hidden Chambers article is particularly fascinating. Let me just read this one little part, John, and get you to comment. In 1974, a team from Stanford University and the Ains Shams University, Cairo, attempted to find hidden chambers using an electromagnetic sounder. Unfortunately, because of certain environmental problems, including moisture in the Great Pyramid, this method was not conclusive and was abandoned. But later in 1986, two French architects used electronic detectors to try to locate hollow areas in the pyramid. They found that below the passageway leading to the Queen's Chamber was another chamber, 9 by 15 feet thereabout. They bored in a 1-inch hole and found a cavity filled with crystalline silica, sand. Further digging was prohibited by the authorities, and no entrances to these areas have yet been found. The sand was analyzed and found to contain more than 99% quartz, which varied between 100 and 400 microns in size. This kind of sand is known as musical sand because it makes a whispering noise when it was blown or walked on. It appears that this and this sand may come from El Tur in southern Sinai, which is several hundred miles from the Great Pyramid. Anyway, mystery upon mystery continues to build, and the Egyptian government, look at Gantenbrink's door and the delays on that. They just don't want people finding out what we think, in most cases, they already know, they already knew, or they have gone on to explore on their own in private without letting the outside world know about it when someone else has discovered something like this passage I just mentioned and the chamber under it. So it's wild stuff. There's so much to that. And the air shafts, perfect. It boggles the mind when you look at the actual construction. It just truly does.
You're right. You know, and the continually searching for this, you know, for chambers and through the air shaft, there's teams ready to go. There's miniature robots that can continue the exploration. And it's been years. We're not talking about months. It's just ridiculous. I agree with you.
Totally. All right. Now, let's shift to our European scientist friends and ask you to kind of give us a little bit of a summary of what they have done and what they have found.
The Russian research you're referring to?
Yeah.
I mean, this is just incredible. When I the first radio show I did with you, remember, was back in 2001 when they first contacted me.
Uh-huh.
And the Russians, Alexander Galid and his son Anatoly, Alexander is director of a Russian state defense enterprise company in Moscow, and he had this dream of building these large pyramids to conduct experiments, and he believed that the pyramids produced energy fields that that had positive effects on certain biological, non-biological, entities. But it's incredible. We're talking about since 10, 15 years of building large fiberglass pyramids in Russia, and these pyramids are huge, and they cost millions of dollars to build. And I think the key is they have been able to produce changes in many types of biological objects, and these have been studied by the Russian National Academy of Sciences and other major institutes in Russia and Ukraine, the Institute of Physics, to show that certain changes do take place. Now, the question comes up is, these need to be verified, they need to be repeated, but I think one of the keys to this is that, we talk a lot about it. For example, they had water that was placed in the pyramid and certain glucose solutions that were later administered to newborns and then to see if fluids exposed in the pyramids would affect the index or ratings of how, healthy a baby would be. And they found out that they increased tremendously. certain viruses that caused cancer or carcinogens being placed in the pyramids, their effect decreased, that immunity increased, pharmacological drugs. They looked at seeds. I'm summarizing things we did whole shows on, of course, agricultural seeds, the yields increased. Mm-hmm. And one thing after another, and this is amazing because this, to me, is one of the first times scientific evaluation of this pyramid energy was produced, and again, by reputable scientific and research institutes in the Soviet Union, former Soviet Union, and the Ukraine. So that's what I think is very, very exciting. And these, again, these pyramids were quite large. 144 feet was the largest one.
That's
weighed
pretty
over
good
55
size.
Tons.
Yeah, sure.
It cost over $1 million. They built almost 20 of these by now, 17 when I first went on your show, and they even had crystals brought aboard the Mir space station and the International Space Station. So it was a really big project. Some cosmonauts were involved and Russian scientists, and it wasn't just a small project. So the bottom line to me is there's definitely this energy field, and I believe the Russians have proved that it does cause an effect on biological, non-biological entities, and most of the time for the good. I don't find anything negative at all that has been produced.
Right.
It also produces changes in superconductivity, crystal structures. So there's a real, real effect that this pyramid energy is causing. So if scientists scoff at, oh, the pyramids can't be producing energy, you can't get statistically significant changes in these things unless something is happening. So that is, again, I felt really honored to be contacted by them and asked to release their information to the world back in 2001. And that's what, we've been trying to do in disseminating this information and encouraging others to try to follow up. The studies need to be repeated by other institutions. As far as I know, they haven't been, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And all this time, you think it would, stimulate some institutes and institutions in the United States and elsewhere to try to repeat their experiments. But no, that's mind-boggling. I don't understand why there's a lack of interest.
Well, this is interesting that we see this alleged administration spending $5 trillion to destroy an entire country, which is what it's cost, and yet there's no money for... Well, same old story, folks. We won't go there.
Yeah, but the other thing I object to is a lot of this money going into the traditional academic institutions, and a lot of it is justified. I mean, I was involved with them for many years, and it's good education, etc. But a lot of the stuff is really, to me, a waste of time and a waste of money. And like you talked about, for something that's really innovative, something new that could maybe have an effect on humanity, they look at it as not valid science, and no money will go into it. I remember applying for grants with kind of fringe projects that they would consider fringe, and I think they were really cutting edge, and I good luck getting funding for those. So, but that's the I think the real exciting thing about the Russian research was that, and the Ukrainian research is that it was produced by in scientific institutions and universities and reputable places and by reputable scientists, Alexander Gollard predicted that there was a hole in the ozone layer in Moscow, mm-hmm. In the area vicinity where he built the largest pyramid, and he predicted that the energy field would repair the ozone layer. And what I was told by some of the environmentalists is that is exactly what happened over a period of time. That they felt the Russian pyramid, the energy field. Remember that we talked about like ion columns of energy going up from the
pyramid. Sure do remember. Yeah.
Remember, the Russian military actually picked it up and said, what's going on here? And they go, oh, wait a minute, that's an energy field over Gollard's pyramid. This is just tremendous. And that may have been responsible for repairing the ozone layer. Now, we talk about environmental catastrophes and our environment. What better experiments would there be in order to find something that may help repair our ozone layer? Amazing. Or increase our agricultural yield for starving countries. These are very, very interesting preliminary results from these pyramid studies, and they need to be pursued. They need to be repeated. And I have to say this, any kind of scientific study has to be repeated. It has to be shown that, yes, this is not an artifact, it wasn't, an accident. And so that hasn't been done as far as I know. And so that needs to be done with all these studies that we talked about. So I always keep an open mind and say these are the initial results. These are what the laboratories reported, but they do need it to be repeated with peer review, which, as far as I know, most of it hasn't been done yet.
Agreed. All right, let's chat about the crystal skull issue. That's going to be big this summer, obviously, after the break when we come back. The Indiana Jones film apparently does spend a lot of time, and this is key to the storyline. I don't know much more. I'm one of those people that doesn't like to know too much about movies before going to see them. All right, back in a few with John DeSalvo as we continue. Okay, John, Stephen Mailer, by the way, along with David Hatcher Childress, has a brand new book coming out all about the crystal skulls, and timing is everything, and they knew when to time it.
Yeah, and I was going to say, Stephen is the expert on crystal skulls, not me.
he is. But you've got it mentioned in the book here, and it's certainly not something that was found in the Great Pyramid, but there seems to be an old-world linkage that spanned the globe, and it was... It was wild at the time. There were so many things going on that this a contemporary culture has no idea about, unfortunately.
Yeah, I agree. You know, there's a great mystery. Again, why I got interested in the crystal skulls for a while, because obviously there's something that seemed impossible that an ancient culture with primitive tools could produce. And in fact, some scientists said that basically a crystal skull would have taken 300 years to make, and literally almost impossible for an ancient civilization to have made it from, you know, one large block of crystal being so perfect and with some kind of super intelligence or super technology used to make it. So, again, you're right. It's another mystery. You see, I think you're right, Jeff. They all kind of tie together. There could be some common denominator, some ancient technology, ancient civilization, ancient source that produced these monuments, artifacts, that had the knowledge beyond what we have today that was lost.
I concur. I totally concur. Now, you have done so many pioneering things in other fields, and there are other things in the works as well. We might, if you want, just anything else you want to talk about, this amazing book about pyramids. We could talk about Japanese pyramids, the Indonesian pyramids, certainly the South American pyramids, and what similarities you see or don't see. And that's a real good topic. They may or may not be linked. It's hard to know.
Yeah, you know, the one thing I would like to mention, I kind of apologize for rushing through the Russian stuff so quickly and just kind of throwing
things
out fast. But, you know, because
it's
of the time,
it's spelled out perfectly in the book. Yeah,
we've done two. We have like three full chapters on the Russian and Ukrainian research, and just about everything that I know is in the book. So it explains it. You know, that's a good point. Pyramids around the world, pyramids on Mars, pyramids everywhere, crystal shapes of pyramids. It seems like it's a fundamental, like a harmonic of nature, fundamental shape of nature that produces strange phenomena, energy fields around it, like Joe Parr has mentioned and measured. Mm-hmm. Other shapes don't produce this, octagons, squares,
No, they're not natural shapes. They're made. Yeah. They're intelligent design, and that's it.
Yeah, I think and so. That's what intrigues me, and it's something like you know, in our hidden subconscious or from antiquity that stimulates people to be attracted.
Well, that's why I say it's. I do think the collective unconscious is a repository of knowledge that goes all the way back to intelligent humankind. And I think people can activate it and access it and do draw on it. And there are, it's like being programmed to go out and in a supermarket and react to stimuli that have already been embedded in people. But it's on a different level.
That's true. See, that's the interesting thing about crystal skulls, too, because the idea of crystals, you know, crystals and superconductivity and computers stores information, you know, the basis of our knowledge. And were crystal skulls possibly a device that stored information, and if we know how to activate it, we could learn about our past? That was one of the reasons I got interested in it, because I thought, well, you know, if there's any kind of material that would store information, whether in a holographic laser type of form, it would be a crystal structure. And then here we have a crystal skull and all the legends about them. So you wonder about, could these be some kind of ancient storage devices? Why are we doing all this? We want answers, whether there's answers in a hidden chamber in a pyramid, whether there's answers encoded in information in crystal skulls, underground structures below the pyramid. We're starving for some answers to our past and these structures, and we don't seem to have them, and it is frustrating. But on the other hand, it's exciting, because I think that's what motivates humans, is the quest for knowledge that stands us apart from any other type of organic life, is we have the curiosity, the knowledge, we want to search and know more about ourselves, where we came from. But it all comes together. I agree with you, and the pyramids around the world just continue the mystery. And I don't know what's going to happen next. I really do hope that there is a renewed interest in more research in Egypt and remote sensing and exploration. And hopefully, can you imagine discovering a hidden chamber with artifacts and information that reveals certain things of our past that we never knew? Maybe it'll bring in peace in this world. Who knows? Maybe we find some statements and things about who we are. We kind of say, you know, maybe all this fighting is really useless.
Let me submit something, John.
Yeah.
You may be right, and I would submit that it is not impossible that that kind of knowledge has long since been discovered by the Egyptian antiquities people and their handlers and controllers, and that's why the lid is on exploration there. They don't want people looking around. I think that it's a possibility. We have to entertain that.
It is, and unfortunately, we really don't know.
Yeah.
It would be a shame, especially if things were destroyed. That would be also terrible. Something completely lost to our future because somebody decided to destroy it.
Our present and our future is being carefully crafted and carefully managed by people who really don't have any respect for us as living beings. And I'm talking about the evil ones at the top. We're nothing to them. Less than nothing. It's a weird world. Would you like to have been alive for a day 10,000 years ago and be able to walk around that? Wouldn't that have been amazing?
Oh, just, can you imagine somebody said, we have a time machine, and you pick the day you want to go to?
I can't. Just amazing. All right, we'll be right back. Once again, we've been talking about the most important new book on the ancient monuments at Giza, the pyramids, called Decoding the Pyramids by Dr. John DeSalvo, Ph.D. John is, of course, an amazing man, a former college professor. He holds a Bachelor's of Science degree in physics and M.A. and Ph.D. in biophysics. And, wow. How long did that take you? 10 years?
About that full time.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
I enjoyed being a student, but I never liked the research because it was kind of introverted. I'm kind of an extrovert, as you could tell. I like to talk. I like people, and that's why I went into teaching. And I
you're a pure educator. That's what you are.
Well, you know, that's where I get my excitement to learn something, to
share it,
discover, and then share it with others. See, if I can't share it with others, I don't enjoy it. And that's I think why I love doing books and going on the radio and just giving lectures, because you can share what you know. It's the best giving that I could ever think of, you know. I got to tell you this. I was really excited. You know, the book was released on Tuesday at the Barnes & Noble stores, and my son lives in Florida, my oldest son, and he called me. He said I was walking downtown and just popped into one of the Barnes & Noble stores to look around, and first table I came to, Father's Day table, had your book on it. I was just so excited to hear that. I was like, what a great Father's Day present to hear that from your son. Just happens to walk in and see your book on the Father's Day table.
Well, it doesn't get any better, John, than to have it on the Father's Day table at Barnes & Noble, published and put up there. That's just amazing.
You know, they've always been my favorite bookseller, and I have to say that their CEO, Stephen Reggio, is really a creative genius. He's the one that expanded the store and actually brought in books and imprints like mine and made it possible. So if it wasn't for him, they may never have published a book like mine. So it's just a very innovative and creative of company. And again, I'm just really humbled and honored to be. I never thought I would be able to see my own book published by Barnes & Noble and on their table.
You're there.
I thank God, and I thank everyone who made it possible.
Well,
but you know, one thing, I don't think I've ever philosophized as much as I've done tonight on your show and all the shows I've ever done together. But you know, maybe as we move along, we see what's important. But I think why we talked about the crystal skulls, pyramids, et cetera, and you kept saying they all come together. And I think it's very basic. I think if we really go to the bottom of people, we really realize the spiritual search is the most important. Who we are. We want to know who we are. We want to find God. Whatever, you know, the word God could be, whatever way you want to look at it, the force of nature, the universe, the underlying light principle. And that's really what our main search is, but we get sidetracked. We think making money is our goal, or we think fame, or we think buying a bigger house or a bigger car. And we lose that, and that's why life becomes frustrated, why we don't enjoy life, and we find it not creative. But what we need to do is open ourselves up to experience the higher spiritual ideas or thoughts, whether it's through studying the pyramid or meditating or whatever. And unfortunately, I think organized religion fails in this. Even the New Age stuff fails. It's just another flip side of ritual or whatever. But I think it's within us. I really do believe that this wisdom, this knowledge, this communion with God is within us. And there's many ways of exploring it. And I think, you know, for me, it's really through science and research and mysteries and thinking about it, looking at the sunset, sunrise, and looking at the stars. I'm an amateur astronomer because I think I like looking at the stars. And I think everyone is different. So what I do is not going to be the same for you or others. But I think in a natural way to just explore the mysteries and open yourselves up to the thought of higher powers, whether you look at it as God or the angels or the force or the light, something beyond us. I don't know. I think, and that's why there's such an interest in all these mysteries now, because people are starting to realize they're getting frustrated with life and the way it is and materialism, that there is higher, something beyond that. And that, to me, is the spiritual path, the idea of finding. And I use the word God again. Whatever word you want to use is fine. Mm-hmm. Finding God within you, finding God, being one with God, and I think that's the ultimate in life is that search. We may never reach it, but I think the search is important, and that's why I always like the first Star Trek movie. You remember they found that he was trying to find his creator, and I think that really tells it all. That's what we're really trying to find, and we see.
Well,
it
we
through.
Want the answer, the
we
answer,
really
yeah.
Yeah. And you know, the pyramids are, we always look at high places to God. Like, you know, Moses received the Ten Commandments on a mountain. Hammurabi received the codes on a mountain. The Tower of Babel, the pyramids. We look at higher places, monuments, as the way cathedrals are built high, like reaching to God. So it's not unusual that somebody would look at the pyramids and say, it may be not even verbalized, but within them something stirs. It's going up towards our awareness of God or a higher consciousness. And remember you once wrote to me and said there's a book, Cosmic Consciousness, and I said, yeah, I have that book. It's great. Mm-hmm. I think that's the key. We're all searching for cosmic consciousness. I like that word, you know, because it incorporates all different concepts of God or higher thoughts. But we want that. We want the answer. It's a natural thing. And I think when we suppress that, or we put it in other directions like materialism or power or greed, that's when we're not natural. We're not the true human being that we should be. So, right. And I'm not trying to be dogmatic, but idea is that...
Nicely said, yeah.
We search for that within us. And I got to say, I think this book gave me that opportunity to explore a lot of different areas, and I'm looking forward to see the kind of reaction now. Like I said, as a teacher, as sharing some information, you'd like to see some feedback, to come back to you, and people will say, gee, you know, this opened this for me, this made me happy, I enjoyed this. And I'm starting to get that, but I hope to hear from others, and I'd love to hear, you know, feedback, both good and bad, because obviously you want to know where you've made mistakes or the suggestions for revisions and different editions. So I encourage readers to let me know if there's something they feel is incorrect or have a suggestion. I cherish any kind of input I get.
Well, I'm sure the input's going to be marvelous. It's just not been a better book. This book goes back to, I remember Peter Tompkins' book on the monuments. Years,
you just read
years
my
ago.
Mind.
Yeah.
I got to mention Peter Tompkins, Secrets of the Great Pyramid.
We've done that before.
Yeah, greatest book, and I hope mine follows in its footsteps, where Peter was basically, he really surveyed the whole area of pyramid research. It was just wonderful.
He did it. Yeah, he was a master.
That was a
masterpiece. All right, we're going to take a break. We'll come right back with Dr. John DeSalvo. I'm going to ask him what's latest on his work in studying and researching psychics and prophets, which he has contributed mightily to with his book, Andrew Jackson Davis, The First American Prophet and Clairvoyant, in a minute. Okay, back for John DeSalvo, and let's take a look at what you're doing now about researching and gathering data to present about some of these amazing prophets and psychics who, and of course, were able to tap into the universal consciousness, the oneness. That's where they get much of it, if not all of it, although it's filtered through all kinds of different things, and it doesn't come out as clear as a bell, but it's there nonetheless, the collective memory and the collective anticipation of things to come can be tapped. So what's new?
Yeah, well, I appreciate you giving me the chance to do that. I'm kind of excited about my next project, my next book coming out, The Seeress of Prevorth. Remember, we did
the Seeress
on that.
Yes.
And again, I was real fortunate because Inner Traditions, you know, Beer and Company, is going to publish that book in December, and I just finished editing the book with them, and it just... I think it's incredible. It's, the subtitle is The Seeress of Prevorst, Her Secret Language and Prophecies from the Spirit World. And basically, we talked about this, where we've studied her inner language, or language of the spirits, or of angels. And this could be the real Da Vinci Code. This could be the actual original language of mankind, the language that angels use. And basically, we have all the diagrams and alphabets that she, we know that she has had written for the first time in over 150 years in my book. We have translated sections for the first time from German. I have some very good friends in Germany who have helped me. And I'm just real excited about this, because it's a chapter on mesmerism, spiritualism, magic, even the Voynich manuscript, that strange manuscript.
And there's another topic for a possible book.
Yes. Oh, actually, Inner Traditions has a really good book called On the Voynich Manuscript, one of the best I've read.
Uh-huh.
But my chapter kind of summarizes that and takes it a little bit further, talks about its relationship to the seeress. I talk about Dr. John Dee, you know, and Henry Cornelius Agrippa, the medieval magicians, and their language of the language of the angels, and how that compares. So, I'm really opening up some new territory here, saying that, you know what, maybe there was an original language that the Bible talks about, the language that Adam named the animals. You know, these are like not actually, I feel, you know, literal stories, but they represent something, that there was a language that if you knew the name of something, you had power over it. Like the Hebrews would never pronounce the name of Yahweh, because if you actually knew the name, it would have power. And I believe that's resonance. Remember, we talked about resonance before in the pyramid, resonance in the king's chambers, all these different things. But I think this could be a very, very powerful research where finding the language of resonance, how it resonates. We don't know how she pronounced it, because there weren't tape recorders in those days, but that's kind of the... I'm real excited again. By the way, the people at Inner Traditions are incredible. My my editor, Ann Dillon, she really made my book into a wonderful read. I got to give them credit, and John Graham, all the people. I've been real fortunate. Like I said, working with these Inner Traditions is a really big publisher, and they're just wonderful. That's coming out in December, and I think I got some information on my website about that for pre-orders or some more information.
Coming out in November for sure?
December.
Move it back to November. Just pick up the phone and call them.
How about even September? And the other project I'm working on is I've been writing a book on the Dead Sea Scrolls, which I've just finished, and we're editing it for for another major publisher. So this has been a really good year. I really am very grateful for the opportunity to really, you know, put together three major books with three of the, I think, the world's largest publishers. So I'm real excited about all these, and it's been a lot of work, I got to say, though. I mean, you know, editing and putting things together and working with directors, publishers, artists, it's really challenging. And these people have the talent, I got to say, and I thank them for working with a humble author like me.
Well, you're maybe humble, but you are brilliant at what you do, and your research is. I remember the Andrew Jackson Davis book and the genesis of it, and what a job you did with that. It was magic. Magic,
you know, I appreciate that, because one of my thoughts was to maybe really try to redo that in a more scholarly, detailed approach and tie in other related areas. And so, you know, I'll give that some thought. Maybe
What you can do, John, is pull together five or six of the truly most intriguing prophets and seers and put them in one book. There's always that, and show where their prognostications, predictions, forecasts overlap and have continuance. It'll be very interesting.
You know, that's a good point. Like St. Malachi, Edgar Cayce, you know, Andrew Jackson Davis and others. Very good point. Even Nostradamus, you take the most famous, well-known, and maybe some obscure ones that were very accurate that we haven't heard about, too. You know, that's... I was interested in, like, some of the prophecies of George Washington. You know, supposedly an angel appeared to him. And,
that's an amazing story that most Americans don't know.
I know. And something like that should be taught in every history class.
Of course it should. Absolutely.
And also the idea, you know, Columbus, when he supposedly, as he's discovering America, I don't know how, but, you know, seeing lights and flashing things, you know, I mean, what could that have, could have been an illusion, but maybe not. Who knows? But very, very interesting. You know, one of Columbus's motivation for discovering the New World was he believed in a prophecy of Jacob of Fiore in the third, 12th century, where he basically said there would be a new age in which the secret language, the inner language of man, will be revealed. This is the one that I'm studying. And Columbus felt that if he discovered the new world or discovered, you know, the pathway around, this would usher in that era. I bet very few people know about that. I came upon that in my research. And so this language of them, this language of the angels that the medieval magicians tried to find, Dr. John Dee, may be one of the most important discoveries we could make. I guess that's the real Da Vinci Code.
Is this something that the seeress, the provost, was involved with? Did she have that?
She basically said this is the language that she's spoken, and she drew charts and diagrams, and I have all the original ones, and this book is going to be the first time in 150 years that all the charts will be printed together with English translations. And I think I mentioned I broke the numerical code. I feel I did. I'm pretty sure I have, and I explain that in the book, too. We haven't broke the language code yet and had some cryptologists look at that. That's more complicated. But I reprint all the diagrams, so maybe somebody out there can, and I encourage people in the book, maybe you will find something that we've missed. Maybe you'll break the code. So I like books like that because they engage the reader could actually make a contribution.
Sure. Absolutely right.
Well, so you got me excited about that. You know, so many new things.
What's amazing is how many really interesting prophets there are in history. I mean, 100 years ago, 150 years ago, you don't have to go back too far, that aren't known. They just don't get much notice in the history books. But there are quite a few of them. There's a South African prophet that his name is similar to mine, but it's not the same. And I can't remember it. But I think he died, 20, 30 years ago, but his predictions were incredibly accurate. So these people are tuned into something.
Yeah, that's exciting. You really made a good suggestion, the idea of digging up some of these unknown prophets and prophecies and putting them all together. Everyone's heard of Nostradamus.
Well, the 12 greatest unknown prophets or whatever.
Yeah, I like that. I can't come on the show too often. You give me too many ideas. You're going to keep me busy too much, you know?
Okay. Now, the December release, this will be by Inner Traditions?
Correct.
Okay. And that'll be the Seeress book?
Yeah, the Seeress, the Prevorce, correct.
Right. Who else knows? Go ahead.
I was going to say the Dead Sea Scroll book, I can't really talk about yet, but that... Hopefully, within the next year.
Now, with your work on the Shroud of Turin, and to back you, when you say I'm doing a book on the Dead Sea Scrolls, it suggests to me a new level of penetrating research may be forthcoming. Are you finding things that aren't commonly known, John?
Actually, yes.
How did I know?
Yeah, I mean, I never mentioned that to anyone, but yes, that's true. It's... kind of very interesting things have been kind of popping up and merging with other ideas, and so I'm really looking for I hope I have an opportunity to do this, a really final credible book to put together all the things that I've discovered that I see come together and maybe hope to answer some of the spiritual questions, at least stimulate others to look in that direction. But the Shroud, Dead Sea Scrolls, the prophets, pyramids, all these different areas.
Well, pick the top 10 unknown prophets, and you can't lose. A lot of them are amazing.
Yeah, I think, and a lot of them within the United States, too. The colonial America and Civil War that we don't hear about. Stuff that, if it was taught in school, would probably get people more interested in these subjects than memorizing dates and battles and, names,
they hate it. They hate it.
You're not the only one. I tell you.
Well, I can hear your pain for all those years of having to deal with it. This one South African prophet, and I can't remember his name, but I can get it for you, was really something. Jan Lamprecht introduced me to him. He wrote several essays, our journalist colleague down there, and the guy is just amazing. But, there's a lot out there, and then right here in America, too. American history, lost... strayed, stolen, undiscovered, there's all kinds of it.
And that's what drew me to Lincoln, my big research on Abraham Lincoln. I mean, all these things about Lincoln with his participation in seances and his prophecies and Man, that's the part of American history that most people don't know. But, hey, listen, thank you so much for allowing me to come on your show and really release my new book to everyone.
Great to talk with you again, my friend. Nice.
God bless you and all your listening audience, and I thank you all.
Thanks, John. Good night.
Good night, Jeff.
John DeSalvo. The book, again, Decoding the Pyramids, at Barnes & Noble, everywhere. And we'll be back.